So we have started going through the book of Romans. Last week, we looked at the greeting where Paul introduces himself in verses 1 through 7. Today, we're going to look briefly at the thanksgiving that Paul usually puts at the start of most of his letters, which is verses 8 through 15. And then we'll look more closely at verses 16 and 17, because verses 16 and 17 are kind of key to the whole book of Romans. It's where Paul announces really what his theme for the whole letter is. And then he quotes from the Old Testament. And the quote is important, not just kind of as a proof text, but because it encapsulates what it is that he wants to say. And also what we'll see is that Paul then uses the quote from Habakkuk as basically kind of an outline for basically the whole first half of the letter. So just a reminder, if you didn't grab one last week, out on the back table, there are these handy guides to the book of Romans that I prepared, where on the front you just kind of have the basics of who, when, where, why, but then an outline of the book. And so as we go through the book, hopefully that'll be really helpful in seeing how the book is put together, because one of the things about Romans is there are tons and tons of verses in there that we all know by heart, but we don't necessarily know how they all fit together. What is Paul doing with the letter as a whole? So hopefully the outline as we go through the book will help with that. So this is Romans chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is being reported all over the world. God, whom I serve with my whole heart in preaching the gospel of his Son, is my witness how constantly I remember you in my prayers at all times. And I pray that now at last, by God's will, the way may be opened for me to come to you. I long to see you, so that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to make you strong. That is, that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I planned many times to come to you, but have been prevented from doing so until now, in order that I might have a harvest among you, just as I have had among the other Gentiles. I am obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are at Rome. I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. The word of God for the people of God. So in verses 8 through 15, Paul's basically just trying to build rapport with the Christians in Rome. At this point in his ministry, and actually it's very easy to figure out where Romans fits in the book of Acts. Some of Paul's letters, it's kind of hard to figure when and where. Romans is actually very clear where Paul was, what he was doing, what he had in mind. At this point in his ministry, he had just finished his work in the eastern part of the empire, right? Paul mostly began in kind of in Syria of Antioch, then he worked in Asia Minor, then he ended up working in Macedonia, which is northern Greece, and then in Corinth in southern Greece, and then went back over to Asia Minor and worked in Ephesus. And this is, he's writing it, he's finished his work in Ephesus, he's returned to Corinth, basically just on a brief trip through Greece and Macedonia to collect funds to bring to the poor in Jerusalem. And he's planning to head to Jerusalem to bring this offering to the church in Jerusalem. And then his desire is to go to Rome and to have their support in a mission to Spain, the far western half of the empire. But for him to go to this new mission field in the far, far west of the empire, he needs the support of the Christians in Rome. All the time he was working in the East, he always had the support of the Christian fellowships in the major cities that he had planted. And we see that in his other letters and in Acts. For him to go to the far West, he's going to continue to need support, and so he will need the Christians in Rome. Now, at this time, the churches in Rome were probably a whole lot of very small groups just still meeting in people's houses. At this point, it is very unlikely that there was much of a central organization or any sort of hierarchy in the church at Rome. And most likely, the people in these fellowships had very different ideas about Paul. Many of them, like we can see in chapter 16, a lot of people in Rome that Paul's greeting personally, many of these people in the churches of Rome had been outside of Rome and had met Paul in some of the other cities he had worked with and had worked with him. Okay, a lot of Paul's former co-workers, like Priscilla and Aquila, are now in Rome. Okay? So some of these people know exactly who Paul is, exactly what he preached, and we can assume that they would be very much on his side. But Paul was an extremely controversial figure. There were a lot of rumors about Paul. There were a lot of lies about Paul, and the churches probably would have had many people who wondered if it was right to support Paul, right? They had probably heard things like that Paul taught that God had given up on Israel and had revoked the covenant and now had given it to the Gentiles. Okay? We see Paul correct that idea later in the letter. There were probably people who had been told that Paul taught that it's good to sin because the more you sin, the more God fills the world with grace and forgiveness. We see Paul counter that lie as well in the letter. So that those who had heard these things about Paul would have been extremely suspicious of him and would have worked against, you know, the churches supporting him. So part of what Paul is doing is that he needs to secure the help of the churches in Rome in order to bring the gospel to Spain. So Paul tries to reassure them that he's the same kind of Christian they are, that he believes the same gospel that they believe, that he preaches the same gospel that was preached to them. One way he does that is that in Romans, he lays out the gospel in much greater detail than he does in the other letters. Right? One of the reasons that we see such a careful argumentation, such a careful laying out of the truths of the gospel in Romans, is that Paul is basically doing a missions moment. Right? He's basically saying, this is what I preach. You've heard things about me. They're not true. Here it all is. He's auditioning, you could almost say. But the other way that he does it is that right here at the beginning, he tries to win them over by just connecting with them personally. Look at the things he says here. He compliments their faith. He says that they shine in the whole world. Their faith shines out. He speaks of his constant prayers for them. He says that all through the past couple of years, he's longed to come and see them, right? And while gently maintaining his very special role as an apostle to bring them a blessing, right, to build them up, he also graciously says that he himself is very eager to be blessed and built up and strengthened by the gifts that are among them. And in all of this, he's opening towards them a heart of love. He's being open. He's going more than halfway. He's showing them love, honor, respect, in the hopes that they will receive him sympathetically because he needs them and their support. Now, sometimes to us, that sounds manipulative. That sounds like flattery, right? Is Paul here being deceitful to win their support? Absolutely not, because everything that Paul says here is absolutely true. He really does love them. He really does pray for them. He really does long to see them. He really does want to build a closer relationship with them that will be more fruitful for them and for him and for the work of God in the world. He doesn't flatter. He simply lays out honestly his heart of love for them, hoping to see that their hearts will in turn open to him. Then, in verses 16 and 17, Paul lays out the theme of the letter. Okay? The gospel as God's powerful work to make life what it should be. And then, like I said, he introduces an Old Testament text that he then uses as an outline for what he's going to say. So, looking at verse 16, The first thing he says right off is, I am not ashamed of the gospel. Interesting statement, right? So, let's get personal right off. Would everyone stand who is ashamed of the gospel? Just joking. No, he's just changing his seat. That's all. In all seriousness, this phrase sometimes is kind of frightening to think about, right? It can cause, shall I say, an itchy conscience, right? And part of the problem is that we think of not ashamed of the gospel as referring only to, like, public street evangelism, right? You're in New York City, you walk past a park, there's a guy in the park standing on a bench preaching with a little handheld microphone, and his friends are there passing out tracts, and you think, I don't think I could do that. Am I ashamed of the gospel? Right? Well, maybe you are, maybe not. Right? I mean, God doesn't call all of us to do that. Although, you may find in the course of your life that the Lord tests you once or twice with something that he doesn't as a whole call you to do, just to help you to see what's really in your heart, either for your encouragement or for your challenge. But there's another way to be ashamed of the gospel that may have a little bit more to do with what was happening in the Roman churches. What if we understand that the gospel calls us to live in a radically different way than everyone around us, but we settle for a 50-50 transformation? What if we settle for just different enough that we can very fairly call ourselves Christians, but also remain in the culture enough that we still get along fairly well? What if we see the life that God calls us to in the gospel, but we don't really dare leave what we know well? Isn't that also being ashamed of the gospel? Isn't that accepting the proclamation, but then making excuses for why it doesn't really mean what it sounds like it means? Right? In Rome, people had accepted the teaching of the gospel, but there were implications of what it meant for their lives together that as yet they weren't willing to step into. Next, Paul says that he's not ashamed of the gospel because he is convinced that God's power to save is unleashed in the gospel. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation. Okay? Paul is completely sold that God's activity in the world to make it what it should be. Remember kind of that big understanding of the word salvation? God's activity in the world to make it what it should be is found, or it's active, it's at work in people accepting the truths of the gospel and going on to live in conformity to them as all the implications gradually unfold. And then he slips in this quick comment that this is the case for everyone who believes, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. And he slips that in because we're going to see that one place where the Romans were not seeing the implications of the gospel had to do with the relationship between Jews and Gentiles in the church. Now, if we believe, as Paul is saying that he does, that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, we will not be ashamed of it. Right? Why is it that we hold back from full transformation? Why is it that we see what the gospel calls us to and hesitate? It's because we're not convinced that the gospel and all that it means for our lives is really God at work to make our lives what it should be. Right? That is, if we're really convinced that doing everything God's way leads to life being just exactly what it should be, we would wholeheartedly throw ourselves into doing everything God's way. I think like we see Paul doing. But as it is, we often shrink back from certain implications of the gospel. In other words, we are ashamed of the gospel because we're not fully convinced that something so contrary to our instincts will actually lead to a full and satisfying experience of life. That is, we doubt whether the gospel really is God's power unto salvation. Example, the Bible lays out pretty high standards of personal purity. And not just high standards, but standards sometimes in like completely different paradigms than we're used to thinking. And our instincts say that we will be much happier if we just readjust those to things that make sense to us. Because we are not convinced that God's way is really best, not convinced that those rules really are God's power to make life what it should be, we make excuses for the parts of the gospel that embarrass us as foolish. Well, you might say amongst your friends, if you're a younger person, you know those church people. They're just old-fashioned. Referring to all that personal purity stuff, right? Or maybe you've occasionally thought yourself, do you know what the cost of living is these days? You can't expect me to tithe. Well, of course I don't lie outright, but some people's ideas of honesty just wouldn't work in my profession. We're ashamed of what the gospel calls us to, because we don't believe that what the gospel calls us to is actually going to make life what it should be. We think we have better ideas of what's going to make life what it should be. Being ashamed of the gospel, shrinking back from all in discipleship, goes hand in hand with not being really convinced that what the gospel calls us to is the power of God at work to bring about salvation, which again is not just forgiveness of your sins so that you can live forever. It involves that. But when we speak about salvation, it is the full, big, enormous picture of God making your life and all the world around you just exactly what it should be. Life that is fulfilling, thrilling, glorious. The gospel says, this way to real life. And we say, well, you've got some really good ideas over there. But you know what? I got some ideas too. We aren't convinced that the gospel is God's power on salvation, so we're ashamed of some of what it means. Now, Paul has gotten all on board with the gospel. So far, Paul hasn't challenged us on any of this. So far, he's just talking about himself. Paul has gotten all on board with the gospel because, he continues, in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. Remember, I just said that we are kind of ashamed of the gospel because we don't see it as God's power unto salvation. Or in other words, we see some of what God says righteousness is. Remember, righteousness, that's that shalom that we were talking about. That's that peace when everything is just the way it's supposed to be. We see some of what God says righteousness is, but we also have our own ideas of what righteousness is. Dude, righteous. Pizza, right? Or whatever, right? A night of drinking with your friends, or just whatever it is you want to do, right? So Paul's convinced because in the gospel, a righteousness from God has been revealed. And literally, it's not strictly righteousness from God. Literally, it's the righteousness of God is revealed in it, okay? Now, the righteousness, and here, this is a good example of where the NIV becomes a little bit, in its effort to be clear, becomes a little bit more specific than the original actually was. Okay? So, the righteousness of God can mean that God is justified when he condemns us, and God is justified when he forgives us. And that is revealed in the gospel. The righteousness of God can also mean the righteousness of Jesus Christ, not our own righteousness, that is reckoned to our account when we put our faith in him. That is also revealed in the gospel. But it can also mean something bigger and broader. And scholars who really dig into some of these fine-tuned things of understanding the theology, the views of people 2,000 years ago, say that in the Old Testament, the righteousness of God speaks of the righteous world that God envisions and wants to bring about. Remember our whole series there on God's mission? And God, especially God's own activity, his actions, breaking in on the world to bring about that righteousness. The righteousness of God refers to God's actions to save the world. And it's possible here that Paul's referring to his own experience of coming to understand in the gospel the righteousness that God envisions and what God was doing in his day to bring it about. Both in hearing the good news and in living out the good news, God shows us what he wants the world to be like and how it's going to get there. Paul saw this dramatically enough, and then he experienced its transforming power on his own skin dramatically enough that he was fully convinced that God's way is power unto salvation. And so he had no apologies and he had no reservations about preaching it or about living it out in all of its radical fullness. When we hear the gospel and when we submit to it, when we conform our lives to the gospel, what it says and what it implies, we begin to have revealed to us, revealed in the information of the gospel and revealed in our personal experience as we live it out, we begin to have revealed to us God's vision of what the world should be like and what God's doing to bring it about. And as we see that, we become more and more convinced that, boy, these things I thought would lead to life as it should be really don't. We become more and more convinced that God's way is power unto salvation. And we become less and less ashamed of hearing and understanding and living out what the gospel says. Pulling these three phrases together, Paul is saying that in the gospel, God reveals his idea of a righteous world and what he's doing to bring it about. And then we either respond half-heartedly, being embarrassed by the radicality of its demands and keeping one foot in either world, or we respond in faith, with that wholehearted conviction that the gospel, with all of its foolishness in the eyes of the worldly wise, which is us, we have to admit, the gospel with all its foolishness is indeed God's power at work. And those that respond in faith begin to experience salvation. Life with a capital L. After laying this out, Paul supports it with a quote from the book of Habakkuk, right? Habakkuk 2:4. The righteous, by faith, will live. How many people notice that we changed the word order there? Right? Hopefully that's a familiar enough phrase that you did notice that we switched the order. Because there's a very good reason why I switched the order. We're more used to hearing the righteous will live by faith. And we're so familiar with it that even if the translators say, well, you know what, that's not the best, the editors and the publishers will say, no, that's a famous verse, you can't change it. Did you know that, unfortunately, there are places in our Bible where all of the scholars and translators say, you know what, that would really be better said like this, and the publishers say, no, you can't do that. Because that verse is so beloved and so famous that if we change it, no one will buy this Bible. Sorry, it's true. Okay, so, anyways, why did I switch the order? In the book of Habakkuk, in the Hebrew, That's the order it's in. In the Greek version of Habakkuk that Paul and his readers knew, that's the order. And in the Greek, as Paul words it here, that's the order. And it's actually important because the righteous will live by faith can only really mean one thing. Whereas the righteous by faith will live can mean two different things. It could mean the righteous by faith will live. In which case, Paul is answering the question, how can the righteous live in a world like this? By faith. Okay? And that's true. But the way it's written, it can also mean the righteous by faith will live. In which case, he's answering the question, who will experience real life? Those who are righteous by faith. Which is also true. Okay? Both statements are true. And both statements show up, and both ideas show up in the New Testament. The first one, how do the righteous live in a world like this? Well, they do it by faith. If you remember, 1 Peter is all about that question. James is all about that question. Okay? But here we have to say, what is Romans about? For those who know Romans pretty well, you know, think about it. Is Paul telling the righteous that they're going to get by in the world by exercising faith? Or is he proclaiming that those who become righteous through faith will inherit a whole new kind of life? Romans is really the second one. Both messages are true, but what is Paul talking about in Romans? And looking at what Paul does in this letter, it's clear that Paul is saying that the righteous by faith, they're going to experience life. Those who respond to the revelation of what God is doing in Jesus Christ with wholehearted conviction that this is indeed the power of God to save the world and make life, whoa, what it should be, instead of with embarrassment or two-mindedness, they are the ones that are going to experience life with a capital L. A life that makes life with a lowercase l look like death. And this two-part statement of the gospel, the righteous by faith will live, then serves as Paul's outline for the next eight chapters. If you have that handy guide I made up, you can take a look at the outline, or you can look at it later and jot a note down to yourself. But essentially, in chapters 1 through 4, people who know Romans well, what's 1 through 4 all about? This is the big, beautiful, central location of justification by faith. Romans 1 through 4, justification by faith. That's the first part of the quote, the righteous by faith. Paul explains what he means by the righteous by faith in chapters 1 through 4. And then 5 through 8, those who know Romans well. What is 5 through 8? It's all those glorious promises. It's all that amazing work that God wants to do in the lives. Remember, chapter 5 begins, therefore, having peace with God, get ready for this, right? And he goes through all these amazing things that the gospel does in our life. What is he doing? He's explaining what he means by will live. Paul saves his explicit call for change in the lives of the Romans, and we understand in us as well, until later in the letter. But he's already gently using his own example of his attitude towards what God is doing to challenge us to see that the gospel reveals God's way to a perfect world, and that if we respond with faith instead of trusting our own ideas of the world or of settling for some compromise between the two, that if we are willing to trust and commit ourselves to living it out as wholeheartedly as we possibly can, moment by moment, we will see God's power to transform life into what it should be.